they're grabbing this solution from you. They're going like, "Oh, I need that. Like, give me that." And so like, as a new entrepreneur, you haven't experienced that yet, but being able to see that, realize that like you will definitely know it when you hit those things because customers are like ripping it from you. "Oh my God, give it to me, give it to me, give it to me." You don't have to push it and those kinds of things. So if you're not getting that, you know you haven't found the important problem yet, and you got to keep looking.
Welcome to the Problematic Podcast, a show that gives you the chance to be the hero in helping solve some of the world's largest problems. Find out which teams need your skills today at problematic.app. And now, here's your host, Sean Tierney.
All right, we're going to try something a little different today. We're going to try a new type of interview. Normally, I interview problem domain experts, and we'll talk to someone who specializes in a specific problem domain and try to unravel that problem with them. And it follows a very specific format. We're going to try something new today and talk to what I would call a skill domain expert. So I've chosen my friend Aaron Eden to lead off this interview series. He is arguably one of the foremost experts in the lean innovation, rapidly accelerated, getting to what works type of experience. He's been a consultant. He's one of the OGs, used to work with Brant Cooper, Patrick Vlaskovich. These were the authors, if you remember, The Customer Guide to Entrepreneurship, famous book that came out and made all this stuff a lot more accessible. So he was their co-founder. And he's just got a brilliant track record, a really good handle on breaking this stuff down and seeing, you know, what works, seeing how to get to, you know, where we are now to something that works. And so how he does this is a whole art form. And I think you'll see why I chose to interview him in this coming interview. So that's the content of the interview that you're about to hear. I also want to drop real quickly something I just rolled out this last week. We now have the Problematic problem taxonomy. So if you go to the website problematic.app, you'll see now there's a new little icon, a little bomb in the menu in the upper right. And that will take you to the library of problems that we are attacking. And so these are all now cross-linked. It shows you upstream and downstream. So what causes what and how they're related, what projects we're working on that attack the various problems. You can watch the problem to see activity on it. When there's a new project proposed, you'll get alerted on that. And it also shows you like how they relate to the SDGs, gives you a quick description and you know, basically a nice way to traverse the problem scape here and see how things relate to one another. So it's a cool new feature that now exists on the website. We also now have funding that's quietly enabled. We're in the beta phases testing this out, where people can actually start backing the projects and putting real funds behind them and purchasing tokens in them. So all that stuff is now live. Just going to drop that there. And without any further ado, please now enjoy my conversation with Aaron Eden. Hey everybody, welcome to the Problematic Podcast. I'm your host, Sean Tierney, and I'm here today with Aaron Eden. Aaron is a startup founder, community leader, and mentor who helps innovators reduce uncertainty and deliver quickly. For more than 25 years, Aaron has used his passion for technology, innovation, entrepreneurship, and leadership to launch multiple successful businesses and strengthen organizations in industries ranging from information technology, healthcare, transportation, education, financial services, and management consulting. Aaron currently serves as principal business systems analyst for Intuit in Tucson. And I have personally known Aaron for, I don't know, like 10 years, maybe more now.
Probably, yeah.
Yeah, more than that. For a while, have worked a little bit with him when he was at his previous company, Moves the Needle. And I can definitely vouch that he has a ton of experience around things like lean startup, customer development, product market fit, and all this good stuff. So super excited. Aaron, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Sean. I'm super excited to help folks that are trying to change the world in a social sense. Super exciting.
Yeah, for sure. So people, my listeners will probably not know who you are. So can you kind of just give like a brief overview, like what do you do? How did you get where you are? Just give us some backstory.
So this is my third time at Intuit as a principal business systems analyst. My current responsibilities are on our modern operations team, applying robotic process automation across the company. So really helping take existing manual tasks and non-value add work and figure out creative ways to automate it, be able to scale our services businesses inside of Intuit. I'm an entrepreneur at heart. I started my first business probably at like 12 or something like that. One of my top values is altruism and really helping others, which is why I think this is a good fit. So, a quick story on the lean startup side of things. So my second time at Intuit, for those of you that have read the Lean Startup book, there's a story at the beginning of it, which talks about Intuit Snap Tax, where we were trying to make it so that you could basically just take a picture of your W-2 and your taxes would be automatically filed and uploaded. And I was on that team. Well, I was supporting that team, and building out reports and dashboards for that team. And so it was fascinating to see not only how quickly that team moved, but also frustrating for me in that I was trying to build reports for this team and they kept changing the requirements on me every couple of days. I'm going like, what's going on over here? And then as I dug in deeper, I realized that it was like, oh, this is actually different. Like your product is completely different from TurboTax. You're trying to learn what's going to work versus actually execute something. And I was trying to build reports through an execution lens. That's why it wasn't fitting. And so it really, that was kind of when the bit flipped for me. I was like, oh my God, there's actually different. There's sort of two primary modes of working on a project. There's learning on one end of the spectrum and there's execution on the other end of the spectrum. And you've really got to know, you know, how much uncertainty and where you are on that spectrum to be effective.
Yeah, well, and certainly I think that's probably par for the course. It's certainly consistent with my experience when I was in corporate is that everyone is just so focused on executing what's there and not really listening to, well, is this even the right thing? Like what do our customers actually need and how do we figure that out and then deliver exactly. that? People just always skip over that. And I think that's probably what we're going to spend most of this interview talking about. One thing I was going to throw out there, like, so you used to work with Brant Cooper. I remember he was part of the Moves the Needle.
He was my co-founder. Yep.
So funny story. I met Patrick Vlaskovich. I met him when I lived in Laguna Beach. I would stand up paddleboarding with that guy. And I know it's like kind of this small circle of people who like really know what they're doing in this space. And I know you guys were all kind of related.
Yeah. So actually there were four of us that co-founded Moves the Needle when we first started. Patrick was one of them. He was working on, I can't remember which start. It was an audio based startup. I can't remember what it was called.
It wasn't Superhuman, but it was something like that.
Super powered. Something like that. I can't remember. Super something. You're right. Yeah. He decided that was moving faster and that it was better to be in a product business versus a services based business. And so he bowed out fairly early in the process, but he was, he co-wrote one of the books with Brant and he was involved for a little while there.
Well, that book, I'll link to it in the show notes, but that book was kind of my inroads into that because I had read Four Steps to the Epiphany and I thought it was fantastic, but it's also really hard to get your head around. And they did such a good job of like reducing that into like, this is what you really need to know and this is how you do it. Great book. I can't remember. It was like the customer or it was something like the guide to customer development or something.
Entrepreneur's Guide to Customer Development.
That's it. Yeah. So I'll link that in the show notes for the people that are interested in taking a look at that. Really good book. All right. Well, so let's talk about this concept of, maybe what you were just referring to where you were, you're in execution mode, you got introduced to this new methodology of like, oh, this is different. They're approaching it where they're actually trying to learn. Frame that for people. Like what's in, give me an idea, like what is involved in this? How did you do that?
Yeah. So it's really a couple of pretty simple key principles or approaches. So first off, it's really deeply understanding your customer. At Intuit, we talk about this as deep customer empathy. In the startup circles, it's different language maybe is used in some cases, but really this is about like, how do you go and see your customers experiencing the pain points that you're hoping that you can solve, whether that's observing the customers and watching them work, whether that's actually you're like working their job for a few days so you feel it yourself, or sitting down and interviewing them. But really, like, being able to like stand up at a whiteboard and go like, my target customer looks like this, right? They're running into this situation every couple days, and here's the emotions that it causes them to feel, and here's how it impacts their life. And like, really, like, you as an entrepreneur having an emotional connection to solving that problem for the customer. So that's the first step, not first step, but sort of first key area of focus, which is understanding your customer really well. Once you understand your customer really well, now you can come up with potential solutions for that customer. And there's lots of different ways to solve a single problem for a customer. And so it requires some exploration around those things. And so that's really where the tool of experimentation comes in. This is when you hear people talking about building minimum viable products or prototyping or these kinds of things. Those are tools that are used, again, to learn, to try to understand which of these solutions will actually solve that problem for the customer and ultimately will get us to the point where that's something that many people care about and those kinds of things. But in these early stages, like, you're trying to like, how do I solve the problem for one customer as that first kind of key milestone? Like, deeply understand the problem and then prove you can solve it once. Like, that's it, from zero to one. That's your first goal. And so, you know, I think especially for folks that maybe are new to entrepreneurship, or are, you know, maybe like in the case of Problematic, right? Maybe trying to go after something that's really big and complex and like impacting a large part of the world, that can be really daunting. But if you break it down into like, okay, we need to understand the problem and we need to prove we can solve it once. That's manageable and allows you to move forward. And then you continue to run experiments and prototypes against kind of the entire business model. And that's how you eventually learn whether this is a business that's worth doing or a social impact that can be sustainable.
And so this process works regardless of whether it's like a for-profit or a nonprofit or an open source project. I mean, you're talking now about like figuring out what people actually want. Exactly. And that's kind of independent of whatever the business model is, right?
Yeah, I've seen this. I've personally seen this work with startups, inside the enterprise, with governments, and with nonprofits.
That's awesome.
And so, and in fact, there's a book called "The Startup of You," I think is the name of the book, or maybe it's "Business Model of You." I can't remember which one of those, but really, it talks about these same principles and how do you apply it to yourself to really understand the problems that you solve for other people and which ones you're most effective at and those kinds of things. So yeah. So yes, it's a set of principles that you can apply anytime you've got some sort of situation with lots of uncertainty. Where you're not sure which direction to go, that's where these tools apply.
That's awesome. I love, by the way, on the topic of principles, I don't know if you've read Ray Dalio's book name. It's incredible, right?
I'll have to show you my ChatGPT bot that I built that gives you life guidance based on Ray Dalio's principles.
Oh, that's amazing. That's awesome. All right. Well, so I'm just going to read off some of, because I literally just put together last week our problem taxonomy. We now have on the website this very extensive kind of overview of cross-linked problems that we are now able to attack. So I'll just start reading off some of the names: racism, prison industrial complex, food waste, ocean pollution, runaway AGI, domestic violence, human trafficking, mental health issues, distracted driving, refugee and immigrant neglect, erosion of privacy, homelessness. I'll stop there. That's about a quarter of them. These are the type of things, like you said, these are gnarly, big, complex societal issues. Mm-hmm. So let's maybe take the winner of our last event. And just to make this concrete for the people listening, just like how you might approach, given that we really try to do, you know, condense this down into a day. So we're really trying to like de-risk and find out as much as we can in a day. How would you approach there. And let me just kind of frame this. So the team that won the last event, they were attacking a mental health crisis in schools. And their thesis was that this issue that we see of like suicide rates, teen suicide rates are through the roof, just very stressful time in specifically in college and universities right now. And so their idea was that they could combat this by creating a system whereby it would pair you up with a talk buddy, and that talk buddy would be someone a little more elevated, you know, so probably someone with a psych degree who had already studied some of this stuff and who could be a sounding board for you, but more so than just like your average friend. They'd have a little bit more background to lend. So they set up this concept, they pitched it, they ended up winning and raising some real investment, and we're now about 80% of the way through building their MVP. But how would you go about, if you're that team and you're now, you know, at the event and this is your idea, what do you do next? What's the next step there?
One quick question. During the ramp up, did they, what level of customer understanding did they have? Was part of it, have they gone out and interviewed customers or spent time with them or those kinds of things?
Yeah, no, great question. So, I mean, normally people are starting fresh. They're coming to the event and they have zero. They just have an idea that they came up with usually. This particular team was a team of four female students that had already worked together on a class project. And this was their class project that they brought to the event. And so they had done a little bit of customer validation and getting in front of customers at that point.
Nice. Okay. That's perfect. Yeah. So if you couldn't tell based on my question, that's the first place to start. Right. So, what I think this team, would benefit from significantly is having that emotional connection to this problem, right. Where literally, you know, they viscerally are feeling what a teen that's going through this kind of situation is feeling. And they can describe that deeply. Maybe they've even gone through, you know, some highly stressful situations themselves, like literally put themselves through highly stressful situations so that they can tap into that feeling. And they can use that, because again, solving this problem is going to be really, really difficult. And so they need that emotional connection to the problem in order to be able to get through those difficult situations. Mm-hmm. Additionally, it will help them with figuring out what is the right message to put in front of somebody that's in this situation that causes them to say, oh yeah, like I want to get paired up with this buddy. And so I'm going to go ahead and take up this offer. So that's number one, is really the same customer empathy and deeply understanding the customer that I was talking about before. In this case, it's interesting because there's multiple potential customers in this, right? So there's the actual teen that's in the difficult and stressful situation that maybe is, you know, thinking about harming themselves or what, maybe they're not to that point yet, but they're like in this really stressful situation. And we don't want them to get to that point. And so they're one potential customer. Another potential customer is any of their friends that spot the opportunity and go like, hey dude, I think I have a way for you to be able to get some extra support. I know you're going through a difficult time, right? So that's potential customer number two. Customer number three is a teacher or a parent or someone else that's in this person's life. And so, you know, I think in that thinking about the customer empathy, understanding those other stakeholders and how those stakeholders contribute toward the decision-making for this individual, And it could be that the way to break through on this is actually, you know, setting something up for one of those other folks that's already supporting of the individual, that could help them move really quickly, and kind of break through on that. So let me pause there. I've got ideas for you know, maybe what some of the risky assumptions are in this and diving into maybe some experiments, but I want to pause and see where you want to take the conversation before I do that.
Yeah. So you're, building the empathy, which, you know, not surprisingly, the team that won it was the team, you know, they had already experienced a challenging environment in college. Mm-hmm. And so probably already had that part just internalized. And so that's why they were already on that page. But then establishing these clusters of potential stakeholders that are going to be involved, whether it's the direct, you know, the end user who's afflicted by the mental health issue, or their colleagues who could potentially refer them to it, probably the talk buddies themselves, you know, the psych students. I'm guessing it would behoove them to kind of understand what they're going through. I know they had this idea that like psych students need credits, basically, like they need to do an internship. And so if they could make this program count towards that internship, then it's appealing for them. And that's how it might spread amongst colleges, you know, assume you get the accreditations and whatnot. Okay, so you're mapping out like the customer segments. Mm-hmm. Are you at this point, and people that don't know about like the business model canvas, are you seeing like a lens or overlaying any of these frameworks, thinking about it in that way, or how are you mentally kind of like stacking all this stuff up?
Yeah, it's at this point, it's pretty simple. It's really just thinking about, you know, what are the situations that these different potential customer segments are in? What are the situations they're in? What are some of the pain points that they're experiencing? What are some ways that you can identify them? So through you know, the situations that they're in, not demographics or these kinds of things. It's too early for that. You're just trying to get after one or two. So it could be as simple as, you know, just sort of sketching out those things I just talked about on a sheet of paper or on a whiteboard or whatever. The Strategizer team has a tool or a framework they call the Value Proposition Canvas, mm-hmm. which is valuable in this context. It doesn't necessarily go into exactly those details that I just talked about, but it's got some pretty significant overlap. So
that's kind of the zoomed in. They zoom in on those two things, right? It's like the business model canvas, but we're now just going to zoom in on two aspects of it and how they relate.
And those are really the only ones that matter right now.
Yeah.
so it's really powerful for helping to move quickly. Yeah. Okay. So those are some tools.
So you've got these clusters and you've identified those. And like, granted, we are talking like a hyper accelerated time scale. Like normally, you know, if this was a team inside of Intuit, I'm sure you guys have, you know, days or weeks or maybe even months to figure this out. We're talking like one day. Do you have any ideas of what a team at that point who wants to go and like get some learnings from these different clusters? Are they thinking like, let's go to a school and try to like physically talk to people? Or what should their thought process be of like, how do we actually rapidly validate some of this stuff?
Yeah, I think that's a good suggestion of going to some schools and talking to people. And that in that context, it's probably for speed, probably reaching out to people that they already have relationships with, and quickly going there. The other thing to consider in this context is that this being such a large societal problem, there are lots of other people that are working on this problem. And so, you know, I talked at the very beginning about understanding that sort of like uncertainty versus certainty context. And so I think in this situation, there is a lot of existing data. There's a lot of existing organizations that are already working on this, that would be super happy to have a team of four coming and helping them on this challenge as well. And so I think not looking to take it on completely yourselves, but look at, you know, how can we find another organization that's working on this that can speed us into connecting with some of those people? How do we establish, we used to talk about it when I was with Moves Needle, we used to talk about it as sort of creating a customer advisory board think about it as like, if you guys are really going to go after solving this problem, you're going to consistently need access to these customers. And so how do you kind of set up a continuous pipeline of other partners that are, you know, getting people to you that will allow you to gain that empathy really quickly. So I think setting it up as something that's repeatable in the speed context. Yeah. Going out to a school, grabbing people on the lawn, like, do that in a few hours, and probably get a light sense of it. I don't think you're going to get to that level of empathy that I was talking about in a few hours time, but you can certainly get a good foundation and starting point for it.
Yeah. Well, we had, so the way our events work, we have back-to-back Saturdays. So they were the winning team. They did a little bit of like, we bring in customer feedback volunteers to our event on the first Saturday. And then they have some time to figure out and line up interviews and whatnot. But that second Saturday, we had some people building the MVP, and then we sent a team just out in the field. It's that whole get out of the building thing that Steve Blank is so famous for. So they went to a hostel, they went to a bus stop, and they actually went out. And I think that is important because you do get that, as I'm sure you know, like when you ask your friends, they're going to be like, oh yeah, it's great, I would totally use this. And it's just like this false sense of, coddling you when it's not true. So I think that was really important feedback. And when they had to approach strangers, the stranger was like, well, why are you talking to me? What is this about? But then they're like, okay, once they're now talking about it, you're getting like this radically, unforeseen feedback of like someone who doesn't care about therapy or someone who's already very, going through professional therapy. So why would they want to use this? It's just,
right.
Yeah.
See, cool. those attributes that make, that tell you whether that customer is a potential good fit. You're like, oh, this product is not for people that are going through professional therapy because they're already solving the problem. So that's not our customer.
Right. Or then there's like a sweet spot. There'll be like some people who already value therapy. There's probably others who are just like, would never do therapy or anything like it. So yeah. Great. Okay. Well, so let's assume that you've now had some time, you've talked with enough people, you're zeroing in, you're starting to whittle down like what the actual problem is, where you fit into it. I like how you said there's like essentially like a landscape out there and there's already a lot of people potentially working on this problem. So don't just like ignore all that and start from scratch. Like you're the only one doing this. Like you don't operate in a vacuum. There's plenty of people already doing it. So how do you slot into that? What's your recommendation? Is it just literally like Google searches or ChatGPT, or how do you figure out your place in the landscape of what already exists?
Yeah, it's interesting because this is a situation where the context of going after a social impact opportunity is very different than a startup opportunity. In a startup opportunity, you're probably doing competitive analysis. You're trying to figure out who's already solving this problem and who are my competitors and how am I different than the competitors and these kinds of things. But in this context, you don't necessarily have to be different. You can completely copycat what somebody else is doing and be able to move forward and make progress. And all of those folks are probably happy to help you move forward. And they're not going to be silent with details about what they're doing. They're going to be happy to share those things with you. So there's a lot that you can learn from those folks. So it's the same sort of tactics as competitive analysis. It's going out and doing some Google search to try to figure out who's solving this problem, who's doing it well. You absolutely could use, I know the new version of ChatGPT with plugins. There's a plugin specifically around nonprofits and the things that nonprofits are doing. So you can actually get it to put you together a starting list that could move you forward really quickly. Reaching out to some of these folks on LinkedIn really quickly to say, hey, we're a student team that's working on this problem. Like, can you spare 30 minutes to help us move forward quickly? Right. They're going to be totally open to doing that and happy that others are helping. So just like you would do if you were launching a new startup, like you got to hustle, hustle, hustle. if solving this problem is important to you and it should be, then you're probably not waiting until next Saturday to go and engage with some of these customers. You've been engaging with them throughout the week and you're coming to the Problematic event on Saturday, already having done a bunch of it and just looking for additional help as to how to accelerate even faster.
Talk to me about those conversations. Like, how do you prep a team that's going into having one of these customer feedback interviews? Do they just say, well, what do you want? Because I know that's not going to be effective, but like what is the right way to conduct one of those interviews? Any coaching advice that you'd have for people listening who are in that position?
So it depends where you are in that process, right? So this team that we've been talking about, they've got some customer empathy, they've got a light MVP. So it sounds like they haven't yet hit that first milestone where they've proven they can solve the problem once, right? They're still working on that milestone. Maybe they've narrowed in on a real problem that they can solve. kind of depends on where they are in those kind of things. But so if you're at that problem space, at that trying to figure out what problem you solve milestone, there we go. That's a better way to say that. Then your customer interviews are actually going to feel like a therapy session to the other person, because you're only going to be talking to them about their problems, talking to them about the situation that they're in, talking to them about what they're experiencing, talking about to them about how they're solving the problem today, not talking to them at all about your talk buddies or what you're trying to do. A really good customer empathy interview maybe says, "Hey, we're trying to help solve this teen suicide rate problem." That's all. And that's all they know, right? Yeah. Like, we're going after this big, important problem, but they don't know how you're doing it or any of that kind of stuff, because you're not there to sell them on your solution. You're there to try to understand the pain they're experiencing, et cetera.
Right. Once and that's a pattern that's a pattern I have noticed at the events, is that once they start working on a prototype, they flip into the mode of like, we're trying to pitch this, now we're selling what we're creating. And exactly. That's really hard to get people out of that mentality. And you're saying, no, you're more in a discovery mindset, and like set whatever solution you're envisioning aside and really just like learn about the problem that person is experiencing.
Exactly. Yeah. So your question was, how do you set them up for success? Make sure that that their interview script doesn't say anything about their solution. once they know, they're confident that they've identified a problem that they can solve. And in this case, it's not teen suicide rates. It's not, people in a stressful situation. It's what does that target customer, how do they describe the problem? How do they describe what they're going through? And is it something where they're saying like, yes, this is something that I've already looked for help around, right? That's a really good sign that's a problem that you guys could go after solving, and be able to move that forward. So once you're confident that you have that problem locked down, then your customer interviews look a little bit different, right? You're asking a few questions to see if they have that problem that you identified before. And then you're asking them lots of questions about how they're solving it today. What's getting in their way of solving it? In that case, you may be getting some feedback on your prototype or on your MVP that you've created when you've identified that they actually fit that customer segment that you care about, then potentially asking them for some feedback on the solution. When you're confident that solution is in the right place, then it's not about customer interviews, but it's around behavioral experiments. How do we actually put something real in front of them and see, do they engage with it, and does it actually solve the problem for them? And so that's where you might get into, sort of Wizard of Oz style experiments or these
the kinds facade. Of things. Yeah. Exactly. Like what the Google venture is called, the facade.
Yep, exactly. So you're like, you're trying to prove, can I actually solve the problem for them? And I don't have the full solution built out yet. I'm just trying to prove that if I did build it, it would actually solve the problem, so that I can move forward with building it.
Yeah, yeah. And what Aaron's talking about with this Wizard of Oz and what I just said, the facade, it's like, what is the simplest representation of the thing that you're proposing to build that doesn't actually entail any coding, any programming or building this thing, but just the facade of it, like a old Western, building where they just put up the single sheet of plywood that looked like the building. So that's all you're presenting to the user at that point. And it's enough to at least have the conversation and take them through and start to do this behavioral experimentation.
Absolutely. Okay, yeah, do you like grab a single talk buddy and connect it with a single person who's in a really difficult situation?
Yeah.
And like, you didn't build the training for the buddy, you didn't do all those other things, but you're just like, how do I connect those two together and prove that my person who's in the stressful situation actually, engages with the buddy?
Yeah. Yeah. And this, it could even be like phoning someone that could serve as that talk buddy role, phoning the person that you know has some issues, facilitating a Zoom call manually and having them talk. And then perhaps if they allow you to observe it, see how that goes or get feedback from both of them. And really it's just like, what's the most like low tech way to pull this off where you're actually learning, does this actually solve the problem?
Right? Exactly right.
Cool. All right. So let me just pair it back to make sure I understand kind of the phases here. So it sounds like the initial phase of customer interviews is almost like a fishing expedition. You don't really know what you're looking for. You're just kind of trying to like understand the space and learn more about the problem. Phase two, it sounds like, is okay, you've identified some patterns and now you're pattern matching. You're seeking to see like, does this pattern hold true? Is this a cluster? Do people fit in this and have the similar problem? And then this phase three is like these behavioral experimentation, what you called it, with a facade or the Wizard of Oz aspect. And now you're starting to validate if you have something that could potentially be a solution. Is that roughly
exactly square? Right? Yep.
Okay, cool. All right. All right. So at what point have you then exited the facade portion of this? When should you feel confident that, okay, we validated, we definitely have something, that we're on the right track. Now it's time to go build this thing.
It'll be a while.
Not a Saturday, not a single day.
That's a silly response, but also true. So as we were talking about the experiments, we simplified that quite a bit, right? As we talked about like jumping into the facade or the Wizard of Oz experiments, we should have a list of all of the assumptions that must be true in order for our solution to work, right? Because we're trying to prove we can solve the problem once. And so, you know, what you and I just described about just getting a buddy and a student and a buddy to connect over a Zoom, right? The assumption that would validate or invalidate is that the person in the stressful situation will actually meet with somebody for help, right? That's all that proves.
The mere existence of that call is somewhat of a validation of would they even have the call?
Correct. Yeah. But that's all it proves, right?
Right.
It doesn't prove that your marketing works. It doesn't prove that having an automated system that connects them together works. It doesn't prove that the buddy would do this multiple times. It doesn't prove that the person in the stressful situation actually got benefit from it, right? Like it doesn't prove any of those other things, and all of those other things have to be proven before you go and build the full solution. So this is where, you know, as you were talking before about the business model canvas, right? We've been zoomed in on basically two boxes of the business model canvas. But to get to that point where you should build something, you likely want validation across, you know, a light level of validation across most of the business model canvas. We talked about the milestones being the understanding the problem, being able to solve the problem once. The next milestone is being able to solve the problem for multiple people that look like that first person that you solved it for, right? So yeah. This is where you'll probably need a real solution, and it's not that you just jump forward from these MVPs and experiments into now just building the solution. It's actually more of an iterative kind of a process where you're continuing to increase the fidelity of your solution because you're like, oh, this part worked. This part worked, and we need it to be a little bit higher fidelity to learn this next thing. People aren't going to believe it if it's not higher fidelity. And so therefore we will go and build this one piece that allows us to learn the next thing. And we're confident that that piece worked. So therefore we know we're not wasting our time by building it. Right. And so this is all about like, how do we make sure that we're not building stuff that people won't use or that aren't actually going to deliver the impact that we think that it will.
Yeah, to me, that was a big epiphany when I was first getting immersed in all this stuff, is that it's really about reducing waste, and waste in the form of like pursuing cycles on something that's just not going to be used or that's not the right thing. And so like, I love that graphic. I'll link to it because I know it's out there in a form of many different memes, but where they have the MVP is like, it's a skateboard, then it's a scooter, then it's a bicycle, then it's a motorcycle, now it's a car. It's like your MVP is not a wheel. Your MVP is at least some form of transportation that you can ride, right? It's got to accomplish the most minimum version of whatever it is that you're setting out to do.
Exactly right. It has to actually solve the problem. And that's why the language I was using was experiments versus MVPs. So MVP is kind of a later on state. but there's a bunch of different experiments that you can run along the way that helps you know whether that MVP, what the size of that MVP actually is. Because I think the V part of it, the viable, the in MVP, the V part is frequently shortcutted. Yeah. We go and hack something together. We go like, oh yeah, this is an MVP. But if it's not actually viable, it doesn't actually solve the problem for the customer. It's not viable, right?
So, does viable encompass? This is a question I've always had. So when you say MVP, viable means does it solve the problem, or viable meaning like is this a viable like business? Like it has nothing to do with the scalability and the viability of it as a business. It's really just about the problem, correct?
Well, in that early stage, your viability basically increases over time. So, yeah. So when you're in the early stages of trying to prove that there's a real problem, then your MVP is validating that it's viable for us to solve this problem. Once you've proven you can solve the problem, then it's like, oh, we need to start looking at the revenue box in the business model canvas. Your viability, now it needs to include the revenue and those pieces. So the scale and the fidelity of the MVP continues to increase over time. So it's not like, I think for folks to think about it as sort of a single thing is misleading. It morphs over time as you learn.
Yeah, the term MVP is contextual to wherever you are in that process.
Exactly right.
Yeah, cool. All right. Well, can we talk, maybe shift gears a bit, and talk about anything that you're able to share in terms of like a scenario where you went into a client engagement and they had something that wasn't working, or there was a lot of uncertainty, and then you did your magic, and then you came to some like epiphany of learning, and now it's brilliant. Like, can you just like take us through anything like a that was unintuitive or kind of inspiring of what, like something you did, what that process looked like, and then what the result was?
Sure. I'm trying to think of an example that'll fit with your entrepreneurs. So one of my customers with Moves Needle was a large municipality out in Silicon Valley. And they were trying to, California has been going through droughts pretty significantly. I think actually now they're finally out of it, but at that point in time, it had been like 7 or 8 years of droughts. And so the city was basically trying to get their citizens to reduce water usage. And so as municipalities do, they got together with all of the, I can't think of the word. Anyway, they got together with their decision makers and got approval for some budget to basically buy a whole bunch of low flow shower heads. And they're basically going to offer these shower heads out to citizens. The citizens could get them for free from the city and then install them, and hooray, we'll use a lot less water. So the team, we put the team through a three day intense boot camp, where they, city council was the group I was thinking of before that would approve and give money. They reviewed with city council anyway. So they went out and started interviewing customers. They interviewed customers that had taken them up, the small number of people that had taken them up on showerheads previously. They interviewed people that had not taken them up on showerheads previously. And what they learned from that was that a lot of people that had actually taken the showerheads, they were sitting on their sink or sitting in the garage. They hadn't actually installed them. And for folks that hadn't, the pain point also was like, oh, I didn't get it because I don't know how to install that, and I don't want to pay for a plumber to do it. Like, that's not worth my time or effort. So the value for the customer wasn't there. And so they're like, well, let's see how real that is. And so their riskiest assumption was that, if we do the installation for the customer, that they'll actually let us do that. So they went door to door with one of the city, one of the employees, as well as a handyman, And they'd show up at the customer's door and go like, hey, we're here with the city. We've got these low flow shower heads. Would you let us install one? And actually they had many customers that literally did, once they were confident that they were who they said they were, they actually did let them in and let them install the shower heads. And so they're like, okay, great. We've got some validation that was true. And that the barrier was the actual installation. And so then they started diving into some of the marketing aspects of it. Okay. So if our existing value proposition wasn't really resonating with this customer, how do we get people to take us up on this offer? And so they came up with this creative idea to do an Instagram campaign that was focused on, you know, local residents. And they called it shower selfies. they told folks that they were going to have a competition for the best family friendly photo of you taking a selfie in the shower after you've installed the shower head, not like, you know, right after the installation, not taking a shower, but right after the installation.
This could go very wrong.
Exactly. But you think about, like, normally in a city context, nobody's going to push the boundaries around that in that way. But anyway, and so they basically set it up where you ask for one of the shower heads and you schedule an appointment. The maintenance person comes out and installs on your behalf, and then you do the shower selfie and you try to win the contest. The shower selfie contest went viral. It was all over the place, got super high visibility. And so ultimately they went from, I don't remember the number, it's been a while, but it was like, we've given out 10 shower heads over the last 6 months. It was a really small number, what they started with, to the point where after these 3 days, literally on the third day, they had 8 installations to go do on the third day because of this campaign that they created. And so they were able to make a pretty significant impact on water usage by getting a large number of citizens to do this. And in fact, because of the Instagram campaign, it actually, many of the other Silicon Valley cities were positively impacted as a side effect.
Awesome. Yeah, just like inadvertently, like outside of the jurisdiction of this one locale, but now they're seeing it and they're thinking about, oh, I should probably get a.
I should do that too. Yeah, that's a really easy way that I could reduce water usage and help with the drought.
That's really cool. So the success of that came from going back and analyzing what was the bottleneck, and it turned out that the installation was proved to be actually a significant portion of why people weren't actually engaging and doing it. So once they prove that by going manually around with, you know, a handyman and actually talking to people and then saying, okay, yes, this is in fact the case, then they installed the shower head and they came up just with this creative ad campaign that happened to be like kind of a clever viral thing that worked out. Very cool.
But it was the getting out of the building and the spending time with the customers and going and actually understanding, not only for the ones that did install a shower head, but for the ones that didn't, right? That was actually where those insights came from. It was from the ones that didn't were more valuable than the ones that did. And so not limiting yourself to just looking at the success scenarios, but looking at the ones where it's not working too and learning from those.
How, in most cases, because given like the nature of what we do, it involves a lot of online, you know, digital assets and, you know, communicating with people online. The people that you miss are really hard to talk with. You know, you would love to talk with, you know, 1 out of 10 engages with you. And then you'd actually love to have those conversations with the 9, because that's where you really learn why didn't it work and what did you do wrong. How is there any time-tested ways that you have of reaching those people that you didn't get?
Well, this is where we're designing experiments, not designing campaigns, right? And so in the design of the experiment, part of that is I know that I'm going to need to talk to all of the people that were negatives as well as the ones that are positives. And so I'm going to design my experiment a little bit differently. And in that case, they designed it so that the customer had to provide their contact details up front. to be a part of it at all. And they couldn't get everybody, right? You're not going to get everybody, but
sure.
But I think it's looking at it through that lens of no, in the way we designed this, it's not going to be a traditional marketing experiment, or it's not going to be, we're going to actually make it, instead of using a best practice survey for customers, we're going to use a gigantic survey that asks for tons of information and lots of details that is not scalable and not the way we would do this later on when we have a real solution in place. But remember, the goal is learning. And right. So we optimize everything for learning. So in those cases, really, it's about like, how do you get those customers, people that just click? Yeah, you're not going to get much out of them. But if that's the case, if this is at the very early stages and you're trying to gain customer empathy, like running a digital marketing campaign is probably one of the later things that you want to do. And you want to be, reaching out to your friends on LinkedIn and Facebook and these other places to get one-on-one interactions with people as your source, even though it's not scalable. But really that goal of going deep with them is really hard to obtain, from a Facebook ad or something like that.
Yeah. Well, I know Paul Graham always said in the early days, you want to do things that don't scale. You basically prioritize the qualitative over quantitative feedback. And it sounds like this is just very consistent with
exactly
what you're saying. So this method of constructing the experiments and the way to think about this, is it accurate to say that you almost kind of reverse engineer it? You're like, what are we trying to learn? What is the data that we would need to have in order to answer that question? And then, backing your way into closer than what is the experiment we need to run in order to get that data in order to learn that thing. Is exactly that kind of right. The way to think of it?
Exactly right. Yep. Either what is the empathy that I need to gain or the interview I need to execute with the target person so that I can learn that thing. And then once I've got a sense of I'm in the right ballpark from those interactions, then how do I run a behavioral experiment to get actual behavioral evidence that that thing that I thought was true really is true? The people actually invited us to our house to install the showerhead. They actually let us in the door to install the showerhead. Not they said they would, but they actually did. We saw them do it.
Right. And that's why surveys are always going to kind of be not worthless, but not nearly as valuable as a click on a buy now button. Tells you more about the buying intent than someone saying, "Oh, I would buy that thing."
Surveys are terrible as a behavioral experiment.
Yeah.
They're great for other things, but as a behavioral experiment, they're terrible.
Yeah. So you would at some point, I think this is way back when I met you at Thunderbird Business School many, many years ago, you had some kind of framework and it was like a experimentation loop. And I don't remember mm-hmm. the name of that thing. What do you use that? Is that how you run your experiments?
Yeah. That's actually a tool that Intuit developed called the Next tool. And it's up on the, I think it's d4d.intuit.com or something like that. We call our methodology D4D, Design for Delight. So that's our Next experiment loop tool. It basically takes you through the process of what I described verbally earlier, identifying all of your assumptions, prioritizing those assumptions, and then building behavioral experiments for each of the assumptions so that you can, learn quickly.
Nice. And in the case of the water shower thing, did you guys, before you even went down this path of low flow shower heads, did they ever do any kind of high level analysis? What percentage of shower, in the overall usage of water, how much do showers even consume? Or is agriculture the thing that we should be attacking?
They had to do that initially in order to get the funding for the program, which had already happened prior to our workshop. But yeah, they did have a bunch of that analysis. It was a quick and easy way to save a lot of water. And then they also had some separate programs they were doing around agriculture. So this was just one of the things they were going after.
Nice. And for the people listening, they call this, I believe, the local maxima problem, right? You can prematurely zoom into something and worry about it. And now you're so fixated on this incremental improvement to something that really doesn't matter. And the question is is that even the right thing to be working on? Can we zoom out and, to your company's name.
Is there a bigger problem you could be solving with the same energy? Yeah.
Does it move the needle, right? I get why you guys called the company that. Cool. All right. Well, I don't have a number much more to ask you here. I was going to ask about like just that experimentation canvas, the name of it. We can link to that in the show notes because that's awesome. That was a really great tool. Maybe just a last question, like what traps do you see most people falling into when you work with clients or internally at Intuit? What are the common kind of patterns of misbehavior or, you know, doing it wrong that you see go on?
I think we already hit on two of the really big ones. So the first one being really sort of pitching or selling your solution when really you're trying to learn about the problem or trying to learn about some other thing, really getting sucked into that sort of sales mode or those kinds of things. The second thing is prematurely building and prematurely scaling. So, you know, once we see a problem, as humans, we're problem solvers. We love doing that kind of stuff. And so our natural state is to really jump into building something to try to solve that problem. And so it's not about not doing that. It's about being very methodical and building individual pieces of it to kind of prove what the whole thing should be. And then I think the third thing I would add is really like just getting too hung up on the nuances of things like product market fit or I don't know, I'm trying to think of some other lingo that gets thrown around. It's
getting attached to the buzzword bingo, like fixated on that, right?
It's just not helpful, right? Like if you're confident that you're solving real problems for customers in your business, you know it. You see, because they're grabbing this solution from you. They're going like, "Oh, I need that. Like, give me that." And so like, as a new entrepreneur, you haven't experienced that yet, but being able to see that, realize that like you will definitely know it when you hit those things because customers are like ripping it from you. Oh my God, give it to me. You don't have to push it and those kinds of things. So if you're not getting that, you know you haven't found the important problem yet and you got to keep looking.
Yeah, I heard it described as if you have to ask the question, have we achieved product market fit, then you haven't achieved it. You'll know it when you hit it. That's awesome. Well, any parting thoughts for the listeners, the people who are, you know, if they're listening to these podcasts, then they're clearly interested in helping play a role in solving societal issues. Any final parting thoughts for folks?
Thank you. I think, you know, these are really, really tough issues. And, you know, in the context of going after those kinds of societal problems, you know, it's often difficult to get resources for it. And really, you know, you're driving this change through your own passion and through your own altruism and through what you care about. Absolutely, you can build a successful business around it, but it really all comes down to the heart side of things. And so I would just say, like, really lean into that. And how do you think about how you can kind of build a movement around this thing? How do you, through this process of learning from your customers and learning about these other organizations that can help you, how do you kind of pull that group of people together into kind of a, you know, a rallying cry around solving this problem, and make sure that you're leveraging all of those resources that exist out in the world to solve these issues? You know, please don't go after this as a solo founder. Like, please.
Yeah.
And thank you.
Yeah, for sure. There's a slide I always put up at the beginning of our convocation at our events, and it's Maya Angelou. She said something to the effect of like, you know, people won't remember what you said or even what you did, but they will remember how you made them feel. And at the very beginning of this interview, I think you said something really powerful. It's like, how do you build that emotional fuel up in the form of empathy? Because that's going to carry you through this inevitable. It's always like 10 times harder than you think it is. But that's how you weather that long journey, is by really establishing that empathy and remembering why you're doing this. So
absolutely.
That's probably a good place.
And if anybody wants help, I'm always here. I'm easy to find.
Yeah, what's the best way to send people? You have a blog or a Twitter or an email, or what would you like to share?
So there are I think 5 or 6 other Aaron Edens in the world. I've met a few of them. It's on my bucket list to meet all the other Aaron Edens, but I have the username Aaron Eden on almost every social platform. Almost. So find me there. I'm on LinkedIn, Twitter, Facebook, whatever.
Cool. And we'll link to all those as well as all these other references and books and resources that we talked about in the show notes. Aaron, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Sean. I appreciate you having me.
Sure thing. Cheers. Okay, that was my interview with Aaron Eden. Hopefully you found that useful. Lots of ideas there around, you know, fixating on the problem, not necessarily the solution that you have in mind when you're developing a solution, how to do those customer interviews more effectively, how to develop empathy with a customer and the importance of that as the emotional fuel when you set off on this journey. So lots of ideas there. He's a really knowledgeable guy on this stuff. So hopefully you found that useful. All the stuff we talked about is in the show notes. I've linked all that up so you can find that on problematic.app. Tips and takeaways here. So as I mentioned, we now have the problem taxonomy available on the website. You can go peruse that. If you are interested in providing feedback on the what we talked about in the interview, the winner from our last event, which is called Onesta.space, that is the MVP that we have developed. It's about 90% there right now, and it's to the point. There is still like dummy data, but we can always use input and feedback. And so if you'd like to contribute remotely on that, probably the easiest way is just to go to our events page. And when there's no event in your city, you will see a little footnote there that says, how can I get involved? And it's the third option when you click on that. You can just sign up to be a feedback volunteer. And I'm sure that team would be very stoked to have your input on what we're developing there. So, and then the other thing is, if you are interested in backing one of the projects that you see in our library, maybe that one, the Onesta.space project, for instance, is going to have some hosting costs and some other SaaS that we're going to need to use for them. So if you'd like to support the project, you can now do that. You can just log into your profile, enable funding in your profile, and then go to the trades menu of your admin, and then you'll see a new funding tab there, and that allows you to load up and propose a trade for tokens in their project. Okay, all that said, thank you so much for listening. Gonna add this new format. Let me know how you liked it. If you like this skill format, I'll just make this kind of a new style of interview that I mix in with problem interviews. And otherwise, I will see you on the next pod.
You've been listening to the Problematic Podcast. To get involved and propose a project idea of your own, or to join in the discussion around one of the projects proposed during the show, visit problematic.app. That's problem, ATTIC.app. Be sure to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts and leave a rating and review on your favorite platform. Until next time, be the change.